This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey and welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast, Friday the 26th of June 2020. Good morning to you. We're having another in our series of Rethink conversations on the programme today. This is a whole series of bits of conversation you've heard over the last couple of days on 5 Live, here on Radio 4 and on the BBC World Service as well. We are imagining the world post-COVID, the positive possibilities, things that ought to change, things that will change. And this morning, in the company of Brian Eno, no less, we're going to examine the future of leadership and how it might look in the years ahead. We've got some fantastic contributors to that conversation. Dame Heather Rabatz, Inga Beal, former CEO of Lloyd's of London, and Professor Nairi Woods, founding dean of the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. Heather Rabatz, of course, is chair of Time's Up UK, former local government chief executive, once too a director of the Football Association. So some very high-powered guests with us. Let's start then with the thoughts of the musician and artist Brian Eno, asking what the response to the pandemic has taught us about leadership and how what we want and need from our future leaders might now have changed.
If we've learned one thing from the coronavirus experience, it's that a certain style of government and leadership, a style that's dominated the last few years, isn't going to be of any use to us at all in the 21st century. The countries that have suffered worse from COVID all share a single governmental style. Macho, media-savvy, authoritarian leaders whose primary talent is self-promotion, who lie freely when it suits them, who disregard scientific advice if it doesn't enhance their own claims. These leaders gain power by manufacturing threats. Mexicans, immigrants, Muslims, Europeans, liberals, whatever you like, to create fake emergencies in which they can appear as saviours. But in the face of an actual threat, coronavirus, all that macho posturing proves to be worse than useless. What was needed was preparation, expertise, cooperation, and good data. All complete mysteries to the macho mind. Contrast the performance of America, England and Brazil, currently 1, 2 and 3 in the mortality charts, with that of, say, Germany, New Zealand and Taiwan, who've had much better results. All those three countries have female leaders, as do many of the other nations with better than average outcomes from COVID. The nations that have done well spend more time listening to their scientists, apparently, than to their ideologues, and don't consider evidence as a challenge to their manhood. It's to their examples that we must look for a future, because we're running out of futures. By that I mean we're running out of choices about what kind of world we might inhabit. The urgency of climate change is propelling us towards two starkly contrasting visions. The first is the billionaire's utopia, where a few rich people secure themselves behind strong walls, while the rest of us collapse in a fireball. The other vision is our only chance, where we rethink our institutions and global arrangements so that in dealing with the upcoming disruptions of climate change and pandemics, we build something new, something better than we have now. This sounds idealistic, but in fact, it's the only option. We have to make a society that works in the long term by valuing all its different intelligences, by engaging everybody rather than excluding most. It's a future built on cooperation and inclusion, not division. We've seen the first green shoots of it in the better responses to COVID and in the proliferation of anti-discrimination activism, which could also be called pro-inclusion activism. If we want to live in a stable, creative society, we need to rethink things so that everybody in it feels welcomed and valued. The more people have an investment in society, the more they'll want to nurture and improve it. This isn't about the winners being generous enough to share a bit of their spoils with the losers. It's about realizing that a world with a few winners and a lot of losers isn't a tenable world.
Brian Eno with his thoughts on what the future might hold in terms of our thoughts about leadership and who we want to be in power and in charge. So my lineup this morning, Dame Heather Abatz, the chair of Time's Up UK, Inga Beale, former CEO of Lloyd's of London, and Professor Nairi Woods, the founding dean of the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. A warm welcome to all of you. Heather, if we can start with you, let's just start with the central thrust of Brian Eno's thinking here, that macho posturing has proved to be, he says, worse than useless in the face of an actual threat, the pandemic. What do you think?
Well, I think that he's absolutely right with his insight. And what has been so incredible is that when you look at the countries, as he mentions, that have been the fastest out of the gates in terms of dealing with this pandemic and have the lowest mortality rates, they are all women. But what is also fascinating is their style of leadership. And so, you know, we've had, for example, the amazing Prime Minister of New Zealand on Facebook showing that she's changing a nappy, not being flustered by an earthquake, just talking to people about what is required of them. To the Prime Minister of Norway with kids, no adults allowed, talking to children about fear and about love. And what we have here are leadership styles which are both empathetic, which have feelings. And we always used to say, well, you can't show your feelings as a leader. Here they are showing their feelings at the same time being incredibly decisive, basing their judgments on evidence, being collaborative, listening. And so I think what we're seeing now is a real formidable sort of sense of this is what constitutes leadership. It isn't the shouting. It isn't the vilification of others or the demonizing of others. It is absolutely about this sense of humanity aligned with clear leadership. And that's also echoed in the Black Lives Matter movement, which, of course, is rightly so, right and centre stage to challenge racism, founded, directed by black women.
Let's move on to Inga Beale. Inga, humanity isn't something that only female leaders have. Surely men are more than capable of it too.
Of course they are. But most of the time we think of different leadership traits as somewhat feminine and masculine. And that goes, I think, throughout not just politics, but all throughout business. And that human side, that sort of nurturing side, is often thought to be more of a female trait, to be honest.
But is that right?
I think there is something to it. In fact, I remember I worked for a massive organization years ago, and it used to have very hard-edged leadership traits as its requirement for its leaders. It used to be, you know, you've got to go and execute, you've got to have that edge. And then they wanted to, the CEO changed, and he wanted to introduce some new types of leadership traits. He was looking for people who were going to be more outward looking, actually wanting to put the customer and people at the heart of what they did. They wanted to have an inclusive leadership style, so that sort of listening that Heather just mentioned, being curious about other people's views. And I remember, this was about 20 years ago, they introduced them as more female leadership traits. So, you know, whether we'd be happy with it being called that these days when we're talking about equality, I don't know. But I know that when I was a leader at Lloyd's, I was sometimes criticized for not being more autocratic. And I said, you've hired me to be me in my style, which is much more inclusive. I'm not going to be there, you know, thumping my wrist on the table and demanding things. And so I do believe generally there are differences between female and male leaders.
Nyree Woods, you happen to be from New Zealand. I didn't think it would be long before Jacinda Ardern cropped up in the conversation, and it did happen really, really early. Yes, she is noted for her communication skills. I mean, I think that's what she did her degree in fact. So she is an expert in that field. But you could look at the practicalities and say that New Zealand, low population, an island, she could lock it down, and she did, and that's why they succeeded so well there.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in the way people explain reactions to COVID is that, you know, I keep hearing two kinds of stories. One is the one that we've heard today, in which there's a lot of truth, but equally I hear the story that actually it's autocratic governments, it's not democracies that do best, that China and Vietnam have succeeded because they've got command and control style governments, they've got subservient populations, and they've got huge coercive control over their populations. That's the narrative that people also throw out. And so for me, what's interesting is, you know, what is going on within these countries that have succeeded? It's clearly not autocratic states. You know, New Zealand, Germany, Taiwan, Greece, you know, these are democracies. And I think there's one characteristic which, you know, Inga and Heather have, and Brian, all alighted on, which is a humility in solving the problem, coming to the table and saying, actually, the central government cannot solve this alone. We need, right from the beginning of the crisis, we need to get universities, businesses, local governments, NGOs, local communities around the table. And we need to be humble in the face of them. In other words, not to tell them what to do, but to say, this is a brand new kind of crisis, and we need solutions to all parts of it. And we know that we don't have those solutions, and we know that you have. So in Germany, Merkel played a fantastic role conducting an orchestra, as it were, of state governments, of universities, of business. When China revealed the sequence of the virus, within a couple of days, the German government had brought their universities and businesses together, and within a few days they'd already started building tests. You know, likewise with those other countries, they all moved very quickly. You know, Greece, you know, the unlikely candidate for being one of the best movers on this, moved before COVID really hit its shores and moved in this collaborative, cooperative way. What's very interesting is 2 years ago, Britain and the United States, in a pandemic preparedness global index, scored themselves as top numbers 1 and 2,
yes,
in terms of pandemic preparedness. And actually, that probably hobbled their response.
Because, yeah. What, total complacency, you mean, Nyree?
Not complacency, more a confident sense that they had the institutions, the resources, the NHS, the Public Health England, you know, that they could deal with it on their own. Whereas, yeah, in Germany, in New Zealand, in South Korea, in Greece, they immediately said, actually, we can't deal with this on our own. No, so
can I,
in January or February,
point?
Those...
Yes, Heather, go on.
In terms of, because I think this is something really crucial here, which has just been referenced, which is about how women leaders tend to form alliances. And that's in part because the journey to power for most of us who have experienced this has been that we have often been the people, and particularly if you're a woman of colour, where you're not heard, you're not listened to, your idea gets adopted by your male colleague and everybody speaks to him and not to you. And what we've learnt to do is build alliances to be able to amplify and enhance our voice as we have navigated our way into the structures of power. And what all of these women, and, you know, Germany is a big, complicated country and New Zealand may be small, but what they have all demonstrated is that sense of collaboration, building alliances, listening, humility, which I think speaks to women's roles to leadership, their experiences of getting to leadership. That is something that is shared internationally.
Can we look to the future then, Inga, and look to a world where, let's say, Britain is going to the polls in 4 years' time, or other democratic countries? Will voters remember, perhaps they'll have to remember, because who knows, the ramifications could still be going on. Will voters remember what happened here? And will they be willing to think of voting for a leader who perhaps isn't all about tax cuts and doing wonders for the economy, but about coping with a crisis of this nature? Will they bear that in mind? Will we bear it in mind?
We will absolutely remember how we felt during that, I believe, and how we were treated. And I think there's a certain magic in, and I mean, and Jacinda Ardern from New Zealand is my inspirational role model, because she has a way of communicating to people with this empathy where everyone feels that they're at the heart of what she's wanting to do. And you sort of contrast it with some of the sort of Churchill-like addresses we've had. They don't resonate with most people, and they don't resonate
That isn't strictly true, is it? Because initially, I think a lot of people really approved of the way Boris Johnson and his government were handling things. I know his approval ratings have slumped lately, but at the start, people were full of confidence in the government.
Yeah, I think they were, because they were hearing this confident air come out. But of course, what we've seen is that it hasn't come through in the statistics and reality. And therefore, people will say, well, actually, maybe that style isn't the right one. And now I want to hear from people who actually care about me and put me at the centre of what they do. And that's why that communication is so important.
Mm. Nairi, women, in order for Jacinda Ardern to be Jacinda Ardern and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, she had to be elected. People voted for her. And it's not always the case that politicians of her type are elected.
Yeah, nor do I think that the qualities of leadership that she's exhibiting are only female. I mean, the Greece is being led by men, but men who understand how to build collaborative partnerships. But I think crucially, Jane, you ask what are people going to vote on? People are going to be voting in one of two scenarios. It's either a world in which individual countries have immiserated themselves, because you cannot control the virus within only one country. You cannot access the public health goods you need without cooperation with other countries. And you cannot rebuild economies in this world without countries cooperating and using a collective form of insurance. Poor countries that Britain relies upon for all kinds of things, for terrorism control, for stopping human trafficking, for key minerals and metals that go into our industry. Those poor countries are already being pushed over the cliff, because the house cleaners that work in London that send their remittances home fund those economies. You know, they rely on growing markets in Britain, but people aren't buying things. They've had to shut down their economies and are on the brink. And then the kind of leadership we need is a leadership which is going to be able to both do the things that Inga and Heather have talked about domestically, but genuinely lead in a Churchillian way for an international cooperation, just as the world saw after the Second World War, that says, yes, we don't agree with all of these countries. We might not like what they're doing, but this is a global crisis. And if we don't actually cooperate together, come together, for example, within the IMF and World Bank, make it possible for even the poorest countries not to collapse into complete chaos and anarchy, then we're all going to suffer from more and more viruses that we cannot control because the weakest link has collapsed, and all the other problems that we know we rely upon, piracy, terrorism, drugs, human trafficking. You know, we need to remember that leadership is not only about those human qualities, but also about having a prepared, as Brian Eno put it beautifully, a prepared vision of what's required for this country to build forward. And that's going to require international cooperation, and that will require genuine leadership to explain that to the nation.
Now, I think it would be Brian Eno's belief, and quite possibly the belief of many people listening to this programme now, that we do need more women at the top and more female leaders. But Heather, you have been the only woman in the room, and it isn't an easy place to be. How do we encourage more women to pursue leadership roles, whether in politics or elsewhere?
I think partly by speaking to and raising the profile of these amazing women leaders who have demonstrated the ability to deal with one of the an unprecedented challenge in the pandemic, and actually hearing more of their voices, I think will encourage more women to feel that they too can be leaders in a whole range of walks of life. So I think that profiling in that voice, and we can see that in Black Lives Matter, we can see that in some of the countries we've just spoken about, and we can see that in an increasing, emerging and powerful female voice, whether that's been in the Me Too movement or clearly in Time's Up. And that has pushed change in across different sectors, where we're trying to ensure that we get much greater equity and representation of women at all levels of leadership.
You know this as well as anybody, Heather. Women who pursue leadership, who pursue success, actually, at any level, the treatment is extraordinary. It can be exceptionally tough.
It is. It is really tough. And I think, you know, it is about having to be resilient in ways that are uncalled for. I think it's about also having that support around you, and women know how to get support. But it is absolutely, it's a difficult and painful road. But if we are going to live in this fairer society, if we are to forge, I totally agree with the international piece, with the international collaboration to deal with getting our economies out of the sheer chaos we are going to be in, then we need leaders who speak to working together and not speak to their own ego.
Inga, what do you now understand about the need for diversity that, frankly, you didn't when you were at Lloyd's, for example?
Well, I was already driving a lot of diversity at Lloyd's, and it was walking through that historic market, you know, over 330 years of history, and looking at it and saying, why hasn't it modernized? Why isn't it fit for today's world? Why isn't there technology? Why aren't there new ways of working? And I looked and I saw mainly men, mainly white men. And I realized then that was the key to being creative and innovative and moving forward, was making sure that there were different voices around the table. So it actually started then, and that's when we started this whole push to get many more women in, many more people from the BAME community. In fact, I think we got 37% of the senior leaders female at Lloyd's, and 21% BAME of the top 50 leaders in the central Lloyd's team. So we managed to do it because I realised there was a lack of creativity. Nobody was challenging. Nobody had those new thoughts and ideas. It was very protective of the old ways. And that's when I really saw the benefit of having diverse teams.
Yeah, I mean, protective of the old ways, which, of course, admirably suited many of the participants, because they were doing fine.
Yes, they were doing fine, but it wasn't allowing others in, and it was very threatening to others. To, you know, you looked in. I remember in the 80s when I started working in the city, and I looked at this terrifying place of Lloyd's, which looked so unwelcoming to a young woman at that time.
Nairi, when was the time you felt at your most uncomfortable, or were made to feel uncomfortable in your professional life?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I've as a teacher of female students at Oxford University, I love some of, you know, what Heather and Inga were saying. I do think that we've got to balance the way, as parents, as teachers, as bosses, there's too much encouragement of girls all the time to be neat, tidy and well-liked, to sit back, to be the smiling presence. And there's not enough focus, there's not enough balancing of those qualities, which all have their place, but to be bold, to stand up and to be counted.
Yes. But you see,
to be not liked.
I find that absolutely fascinating. But there has been a lot of talk, even in this conversation, about collaboration and indeed nurturing. So it's all still there in the mix, isn't it? Do you remember a book, I think we featured it on this programme, The Hillary Paradox, about Hillary Clinton's problem being that women didn't quite like her enough?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that, Nairi?
Yeah. So I know I spend a lot of time with my female students on exactly that, on balancing the need to be liked with a much more important thing, which is being trusted. Being trusted to be someone that stands up for the right things and being trusted to be somebody that achieves the goals that they set out to achieve. And I think even in boardrooms, I notice, you know, that for whatever reason, the females that come out of the room will often be more concerned about the emotional state of everybody else. Was he unhappy? Was he displeased by this? And the male colleagues will come out of that room saying, yes, I got what I wanted, or no, I didn't get what I wanted. And I think ensuring there's a balance between the goals that you set, helping, you know, women and the girls in your own homes set goals, focus on the goals instead of the people all the time. Of course, we also need to focus, boys, on being empathetic and humble and bringing a collaborative approach to problems. But I would love to see more encouragement of girls to be bold, to set goals and to pursue those goals.
Mm, and it's up to the parents of girls to actually give them permission to be, well, not that interested in playing nice, as you say. Heather, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, well, I think it's for the parents, it's for the education system. It's also for all of our media, how we present young women, that to have a sense of confidence in themselves, a belief in their own self-esteem, that it isn't dependent on being Miss Popular but absolutely about standing your own ground, and that is something that is cool, and that is something that is going to guide you through life and give you that strength and fortitude. And the rewards are huge in terms of living that life to your maximum potential and maximum fulfillment. And I think the more that we can see those sorts of images, and we see them increasingly with young women musicians and actors and people from across the creative industries, the more that we see that, the more that young girls can have that sort of modelling in front of them with images and which reinforce that, I think that is hugely important. It's been very interesting, the Lionesses at the FA, they've been doing huge podcasts to young girls to encourage them to stay fit. They've been way more successful than the guys.
Yes.
And that, I think, is, you know, one of the interesting turning points that we're seeing coming through this pandemic.
But we can't. The mainstream media is still full of hogwash about losing weight after, you know, you've put weight on in lockdown.
It is.
Well, it's all cobblers, but to a degree, most of us play along with it up to a point, don't we? To my shame.
Yep. Well, we do. And of course, we all play along with a whole sweep of things, but it's also about not playing along all the time. It's also about presenting this other voice. And we are seeing that start to happen amongst brands who are recognising that actually, if you are going to appeal to women, then there have to be different images associated with it. And it is about the people you have sitting in your studio today, Jane, in all of our lives, in business and in education and in sport, about how we take some of these points that we've been rehearsing today and amplify them in our daily lives.
Yeah, and it's up to us, of course, to big up other women and to offer our support to them. Really briefly, Inga, would you swap places with one of the incredibly intelligent and capable young women that Nairi Woods is educating at Oxford? Have they got it easier than you had it, do you think?
They've got it easier in terms of there's lots of conversation happening, and I think there's a greater understanding of the need for equality. However, I think today's world is much tougher than when I was starting out on my career. I really believe that when I see the pressure on young people, it is truly immense. And when I just walked in, I had several job offers made at the same time in the 80s. It was a different era.
Right.
At that time.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. So, that's actually a bit of a negative note to end on. Bit of a shame. Never mind.
Well, they've got lots of opportunity. Come on. There is a lot of opportunity out there for women in particular.
Brilliant. Lovely to talk to all three of you. Really enjoyed it this morning. Thanks for all your wisdom. Inga Beale, the former CEO of Lloyd's of London. You also heard from Dame Heather Abatz and Professor Nairi Woods. And your thoughts are welcome, of course, at BBC Woman's Hour on Twitter, or you can email the programme via our website. Next week, we've got a series on women and gaming. And it turns out, actually, that loads of women are actually heavily involved in gaming, including some over 70s. And you can hear from some of them on Woman's Hour next week. Now, to a Netflix documentary I recommend. It's not the easiest watch, but it's absolutely vital that we understand this. It's called Athlete A, and it's a documentary about the serial sexual and psychological abuse at the heart of US gymnastics. A man called Larry Nassar, who was the American national team doctor for over 30 years, was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for the sexual assault of minors in 2018. And tragically, over 500 survivors of Larry Nassar have now come forward. Many young American gymnasts spent time at the Caroli Ranch, a place run by two Romanian coaches who'd previously worked with Nadia Comăneci. Jennifer Say is the producer of the documentary Athlete A and a former gymnast herself. She hadn't been a victim of Nassar, but in 2008, her book Chalked Up laid out the emotional and physical abuse she had gone through in American gymnastics in the 1980s.
When I wrote it, I was almost 40 years old, but I continued to struggle with some of the physical and emotional abuses that were pretty commonplace for coaches in the United States. And I couldn't quite sort of make peace with it. And so eventually, as a mother of two and a working professional, I just sort of sat down to write it, to kind of make sense of it all. And it came out before the Olympics in 2008 and definitely kicked up some dust. People were pretty upset by it, I would say, in the community. And really all I meant to do was, you know, a truthful retelling of what I had experienced in the sport, which was not only unusual, but quite abusive.
How were you treated?
I mean, it was pretty commonplace, so it was easy to sort of think that it was my fault that I continued to struggle with it. But the coaches that I trained under, we were belittled and berated for our weight. We were called fat pigs. We were weighed in multiple times a day, humiliated in front of our teammates. We were screamed at for being lazy when perhaps we were injured and struggling to train. And when I say injured, I mean seriously injured, like broken ankles, but not getting proper medical treatment. So we often trained on serious injuries. You know, they threw things at us when they felt we weren't working hard enough. All of these kinds of things were pretty commonplace in my gym and others as well.
Right. All of which gives us a really clear idea of why you are so invested in the notion of Athlete A and why you've put so much hard work into getting it made. But from what you say there, nothing changed. You wrote that book. You made it clear that life was completely unacceptable for you as a young girl. But if anything, it just got worse, didn't it?
Well, I would certainly say it didn't change. You know, and I described a time in the 1980s, and I wrote about a coach who was the national team coach at the time who I traveled with around the world and the country. And he was a sexual abuser. And ultimately, he, you know, some of the women that he abused came forward in about 2011, and he was ultimately banned from the sport due to pressure. But I would say largely there were no widespread cultural changes. There was no real admission that there was something wrong. It was treated as anomalous. It was treated as sort of, I was this dissatisfied, angry, bitter ex-gymnast who never quite achieved the success that she wanted and was out to make a buck in a book. And so it wasn't really examined with any diligence or honesty, and not to kind of look inside and say, perhaps we have a problem, but to blame the person who was speaking out and dismiss and discredit them. And for many years, that was effective. Honestly, it was quite effective. But with the Larry Nassar story breaking, there were just too many voices. You know, nearly 500 women came forward, and you can't dismiss and belittle that many. You could try. But even now, with that having happened, I believe it's looked at as anomalous and not something sort of deeply broken in the culture. It's a sort of, he was one bad apple and now he's gone and so we're okay. And that's what I think is really problematic.
Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles is going public today, saying she was among the athletes who were sexually abused by Larry Nassar.
Several Olympic champions have also come forward, including Allie Raisman, Michaela Maroney, and Gabby Douglas. Maggie Nichols first came forward more than 2 years ago, but her identity has not been publicly known until now.
Maggie did not want to be here today. She is a full-time student, and she's training as a full-time athlete still for the University of Oklahoma. So this is, it's too painful. So I'm going to read the statement from that she put out to the public. USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee did not provide a safe environment for me and my teammates and friends to train. We were subjected to Dr. Larry Nassar at every national team training camp, which occurred monthly at the Crowley Ranch. Up until now, I was identified as Athlete A by USA Gymnastics, the United States Olympic Committee, and Michigan State University. And I want everyone to know that he did not do this to Athlete A. He did it to Maggie Nichols.
Larry Nassar was the USA Gymnastics team doctor for nearly three decades. And he also treated many girls in a club program at Michigan State University. I mean, he must have treated thousands over his years as a sports medicine doctor. And he was systematically sexually abusing these girls under the guise of medical treatment. He listened to them. He talked to them. He was sort of a safe harbor, especially for those girls training under USA Gymnastics and training at the Crowley Ranch, where the conditions were incredibly harsh. He offered them food. He offered them an ear. And that was his strategy. That was part of the grooming. And it made these young women question what they felt was happening, what they knew was happening. But they thought, well, he's this revered doctor. I'm grateful to see him. This can't be happening. He's being nice to me. I just need to let it go. And that's what's incredibly insidious about abuse in general, is you come to believe it's your own fault. It's true of the physical abuse, the emotional abuse, and certainly the sexual abuse. And so for many, many decades, he was able to get away with it. But he was sort of the one kind person in their midst. And he was obviously the most abusive of all.
Which is a horribly troubling state of affairs. And the arrogance of the man was quite breathtaking. In the end, he was abusing girls sometimes when their mothers were in the room.
He did, in fact, and there is a woman in the film, Rachel Denhollander, who plays such a critical role in the unfolding of the story, because she was the first to come forward and tell her story with her name and her likeness, and that prompted so many more to begin to come forward. Within a few weeks of her telling her story, there were well over 50 credible survivors that had come forward, and she tells the story in her own book how he abused her the first time with her mother in the room. He would position himself between her and the patient's mother. He used a towel or something, and he would do it right there. And the child, because she was a child, was sort of so confused and disoriented that she didn't say anything. These are children. They don't really know what's happening. He's a trusted doctor.
Jennifer, what has the impact of all this been on fans of American gymnastics? There are so many of us who love to see it. Simone Biles she's an international heroine, and she too has had to talk about being a victim of Larry Nassar. What's it all done for the sport?
Women's gymnastics is the most watched sport in the Summer Olympic Games. It's not watched widely in between. So, you know, I wouldn't say that the viewership has suffered necessarily. Certainly, USA Gymnastics, the governing body for the sport, has severely suffered. They've lost all their sponsorship dollars. They're incredibly challenged right now. People do not trust them as a governing body, and why would you? But I think people, fans of the sport, remain quite enthralled with the heroes. Simone Biles, Allie Raisman, a two-time Olympian and medalist who also came forward, many Olympians, Michaela Maroney. I think our respect for them is just deepened, but I think casual viewers especially certainly have questions about how the sport and the training is conducted. But unfortunately, I don't believe anything has really changed.
Well, what about parents? I mean, if you're a parent, surely now in the United States and no doubt elsewhere, you've got to question your child spending long periods of time away from home with who knows who.
I think largely that is the case, but you have to understand in this culture, this sort of microcosmic culture where winning is everything. You have this child that is better than you ever could have imagined, and she's incredibly driven, and she just wants to be the next Simone Biles or Allie Raisman, and she wants to train, and she'll put herself through anything. I mean, I know, and I'm not putting myself in the category of those athletes, but I would never have shared with my parents what was happening. I didn't want them to take me out. And the parents get caught up in it too. And you hear from parents in the film, you know, you hear from Maggie Nichols' parents, they trust. And certainly that trust is shaken a bit right now. But you have to understand, even here in America, there are parents of athletes now who are very resentful that all of this has come out. They feel that it's unwarranted, that it's just tough coaching, and that this uproar is ruining it for the next generation of athletes. Believe it or not, there is a contingent, a widespread contingent, that just wants to move on and from this, you know, horrible
scandal. I find
scandal
that
and
really troubling. That there are still parents and people who'd simply rather this was all brushed under the carpet. It can't be serious.
It is incredibly troubling. And I think the thing is it's just so, it's such the accepted coaching methodology, what I described in the beginning that I went through. It's just the way it is. And so people in their minds have said, well, that's just tough coaching. If you want to be the best, that's what's required. And if you can't take it, then you're weak and you need to get out. Now, there's a bright line around sexual abuse, but it all creates the conditions for the sexual abuse to happen. Mm. If you emotionally and physically abuse a child the way I described, they're broken down to the point where they don't know up from down and right from wrong, and they don't even trust their own experience in the world. And so if they are marched into Larry Nassar's office, they will accept it as either their own fault or as nothing wrong and their own fault that they're suffering from it. And so you have to tackle all of it, the physical, the emotional, and the sexual abuse. And I don't believe that reckoning has come.
Right. It's really worrying. Something else I took from Athlete A was a reminder of the time when Olympic gymnasts were not little girls, but grown yeah. women. Do you actually think we'd be better reverting to that and actually saying, you know what, you can't go to the Olympics, you can't compete unless you're, say, at least 20 or 18, or would you do that?
I mean, there definitely is a contingent that believes that. I would say even if you're going to the Olympics at 18 or 20, you're still probably training incredibly intensely as a child. So I don't think that's the end-all, be-all solve. I'll just say that. I think it would be healthier. You know, I think a very young child, if you're going to the Olympics when you're 15 or 16, you know, you're training in this incredibly intense way at 8 or 10 years old. I mean, imagine that. Mm-hmm. So if you raise the age a bit, you can kind of move that out a bit. But I don't think that is the only solve. There has to be a reimagining of the coaching culture in the sport that is one that puts child safety first. There just has to be. And right now there isn't. It is a culture that puts winning and medals first, and the athletes are collateral damage.
Collateral damage, it's as bad as that, or it can be.
I believe that it is. And for all the winners that USA Gymnastics has produced, and there are a lot since the mid-90s, imagine how many there are that fell by the wayside because of these methods. I mean, I know too many. I know there's more than the ones I know.
That was Jennifer Say, and the documentary Athlete A is on Netflix now. The US Department of Justice is investigating USA Gymnastics, the US Olympic Committee, and indeed the FBI for its handling of allegations of sexual abuse of athletes. Your thoughts on that? A listener says, Jeanette says, I've stopped watching women's gymnastic events because I can't stand how much makeup they seem to have on. It's ridiculous with such young girls that their faces are plastered in the stuff. Makeup should be banned in the event. I don't care about their prettiness. I just want to see them performing gymnastics. On Twitter, another listener says, my children have been through emotional and physical abuse in gyms in Britain. Well, that's really disappointing to hear, although I suppose not surprising. Louise says, I'm lying in bed with a fractured fibula and I'm horrified that young gymnasts were forced to train with serious injuries on top of all the other physical and emotional abuse they seem to have suffered. Yes, that was, it's very upsetting, isn't it? Not least because we all, and I'm among the viewers of gymnastics at the Olympics, I absolutely love it. It's really compelling. Now, many of you enjoyed hearing from Brian Eno on the subject of women leaders and the future of leadership in the light of how various countries have dealt with the pandemic. In fact, quite a few of you are asking just for a copy of the transcript of what he had to say. But I need to point to the fact that Emma Robinson is not the only person to have tweeted, or rather emailed in her case, along these lines. She says, "I don't understand why Woman's Hour, I thought the clue is in the title, should be promoting the male voice with their take on the post-COVID world." Emma, yes, I absolutely take your point. And interestingly, I too mentioned this in a one of my sort of pre-programme strops, which are traditional and which happen round about 8:30 on the morning of a programme. People know just to ignore me, basically. But that was one of the things I mentioned because, yes, I was a bit puzzled by that too. Now, what I have to say to you, Emma, is what was explained to me, which is that this is a pan BBC radio series of conversations. And it just so happens that Brian Eno wanted to do his essay on this topic, and he's a big name and he was making some interesting points, so that is the explanation. But yes, I don't blame you, I have to say, for asking exactly that question. This from Joe: "I really enjoyed this morning's discussion on women in leadership. It's not the first time you've tackled this, of course, but I would have been happy to listen to a whole programme devoted to that discussion." Well, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. "In Scotland, we have an excellent First Minister, in my view, who is a woman, of course, Nicola Sturgeon, and who I'd suggest has good communication skills and empathy for all parts of our society, which have been well in evidence in her COVID briefings. At the point when you stopped the discussion, it was getting interesting about the psychological and cultural hurdles women struggle with in putting themselves out there. How can we address this at a personal level? I speak as a privileged white middle-class woman who still finds it hard to stick her head above the parapet. More on this topic, please, with some practical ideas." Joe, thank you for that, and noted. Yes, I think you're right. We could have used the whole programme for exactly that conversation. Nuala says, "Jane, it's time Women's Hour did start to big up women leaders in the UK instead of continuing to constantly champion New Zealand and Germany. We've heard all this already. Boris Johnson isn't the only face of leadership. Arlene Foster and Michelle O'Neill, of course, in Northern Ireland, they deserve to be applauded at the moment. And Nicola Sturgeon and Jane Freeman in Scotland are also front and centre of the COVID lockdown debate and handling. Nuala says, I appreciate Women's Hour going global, but maybe going outside London or England once in a while would be a good idea. Joanna says, I worked at Lloyd's in the 90s. I was sitting next to a man who I was told didn't like women or graduates, and he was vile to me. When I complained to my boss, I was told I needed to smile more. Wow. Well, let's hope that's a thing of the past. And finally, to an important topic, which I suspect will get many of you going. This from, I don't think we need to mention her name, but she was in Lidl's in Dorchester the other day and witnessed this. A couple handling every single avocado in the box before selecting one. It's not a COVID-friendly thing to do. I was waiting for them to move along, as you do, and watch them examine every fruit in the box. I've also recently seen a man burying his face in a basil plant. Right, listeners to the Women's Hour podcast, don't allow this to happen in any supermarket you venture into. Our emailer is quite correct. It isn't a good thing to be doing right now. Thanks to everybody who's taken part in the programme today and indeed throughout the week. We're back tomorrow with the highlights of the Women's Hour week with Weekend Women's Hour, both on the radio and in podcast form. And back live Monday morning, 10:03. Amongst other things, we're talking about women in gaming.
Hi, I'm Catherine Bowhart.
And I'm Sarah Keyworth. We're comedians separately and a couple together, and we're the host of You'll Do, the podcast that gives you a little insight into perfectly imperfect love.
Yeah, forget nights in with this one and hashtag couples goals. We want to know the whys and hows of sticking with the people we love and asking a few of the questions that are meant to help us develop intimacy.
So why not give it a listen and subscribe to You'll Do on BBC Sounds.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.